Brian Alcoholic? Alright, yeah. Yeah, the whistles. Peter did a great job, I think. I don't know. I think he did a really good job. Yeah, I love you too, Dan. My sobriety date is July 5th, 2004. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor others, like Wonderful Peter over there. I have a home group. It's Bill and Bob's Excellent Adventure on Saturday night. It's a great meeting. You should check it out. It's great. Check it out. Yep. I'm at like a loss right now. That's like a rarity for me, anybody that knows me. I can talk a lot. I think I'm just faded from today. We had a chocolate party at work, and I got chocolate wasted, as I like to say. They had so much free cocoa, and it was just, I loaded it on with marshmallows and chocolate chips, and my wife's probably mad at me right now because I'm not supposed to be eating sugar, because I feel like I have early onset of diabetes from a dramatic thing that happened. I'm very dramatic. You'll learn that about me in my story. If one thing's wrong in me, like an ache or a pain, I definitely have cancer or HIV. where to begin? You know, what Peter said to me, or said about me, still shocks me. That people were around me, that they gravitated towards me. And a lot of people are weird when I say, get weirded out when I say this, but like, I'm not a very personable person. I don't like confrontation. I don't like meeting new people. I'm at a new job recently, and I eat by myself in this giant cafeteria every day, and I take selfies to show my wife that, eating with my friends, and there's nobody there except some random old woman behind me eating a sandwich. I'm just weird like that, and that people gravitate towards me. I was the kind of kid that in like high school I would get calls from like friends while like on the way to their house saying, yeah, my mom found out that you were coming over and you're not allowed over anymore, you know, because that's the kind of kid I was. That was my reputation I had in school. I was the bad kid, and I never used to be like that. The majority of my progress reports when I was little, it was always, you know, excels and X, Y, and Z, needs to work on this and this and this, but always the underline was so much potential, so much unused, wasted potential. And that still followed me, I think, today. I get reports at work probably that say unused potential a lot. I grew up in Chicago in an alcoholic, drug-infested home. My mom is one of us that is still not come to these rooms. She's been to rehab quite a few times. My dad is in a different fellowship, and he got sober or clean like a year and a half after me, so I always brag to him that I have more time than he does, which is fun. And so the disease is definitely, you know, is definitely there. You know, and the big thing that I drive home the most to my sponsees when we do step work is the doctor's opinion. You know, medicine is always, and science has always fascinated me because I'm not good at it, and I want to be good at it. And I think just the term Dr. Knitch would be really cool to use, and I know I'm never going to do it, so I just pretend like I'm a doctor a lot. And what we do is we go over that, and it shows how the manifestation of, you know, alcoholism as a disease and how it progresses within us. And it's just how unknown it is still, you know, in various medical journals that they still can't put a concrete nail into it, that this is what causes this, you know. And the phenomenon of craving and the whole aspect of that to obsession with us as alcoholics, or for me, I'll speak for myself, is baffling, you know. And it's not a cop-out, so to speak, but it lets, I think it taught me early on, and it teaches some of the new guys that I work with, that a lot of this is out of your control. It puts the whole idea of powerless in there, like really, it's really substantial when you advise them of that, especially when I was advised of that, you know, this is something that's out of your control the majority of your time, and the only way that you're going to get over this is with the foundation that I learned, at least, in AA and spirituality. And I didn't like that in the beginning, being told that, you know, these simple things on the wall and that believing in a God was going to take away that feeling of wanting to get, you know, wasted 24/7. Just didn't seem possible to me. Well, growing up in my home, it was chaos. My mom went to rehab a few times, and when we were younger, and my parents divorced when I was like 7 or 8, and my dad got full custody of me and my brother, which is a rarity for the father to get custody back then. I think even still now, maybe, I don't know, but the courts did not see my mother fit to raise 2 young children, let's just say, and for good reason. People that know my mother know that. She tried her best, though, you know, and there was resentment there, and there was anger that I worked on later in therapy, in rehab, that I didn't believe was going to work, but it did. And, you know, it's a shame. But I've been able to gain a relationship with her that's beyond my wildest dreams. Pretty cool stuff, and I'll talk about that later. So when they divorced, we moved away from downtown, and my dad got remarried real quick, so did my mom. And my mom married like a younger Sicilian blue-collar union leader. Weird guy. Small hands. Me and Jody call him Nubs. I always tell him not to look at his hands when he sees them, and he always does, and it makes him really uncomfortable. That's a birth defect. I shouldn't be making fun of him, but... I know, right? Isn't that bad? And then my dad married, like, this semi-Orthodox Jewish woman. So I had, like, 2 opposites right there. I had, like, young new dad that was, like, really young. My mom married a really much younger man than her. And so we, like, had, like, this, like, chaos. We would see her on the weekends. Eventually my mom got custody to see us on the weekends, and we would go, like, to downtown to visit my mom for the weekend, and it would just, like, be chaos. Like, go-karts and motorcycles. He was a gearhead. He still is. So we would, like, just get crazy, and we had Sega Channel, which was awesome, if anybody remembers Sega Channel. I had Sega Channel. And we would just, like, stay up. We were allowed to smoke cigarettes there and, like, sneak booze. Like, my mom knew we were sneaking booze, but she didn't care. Like, eventually it turned out that she would just have a drink with us, like, every night. And then we'd come home to my dad to, like, this... They moved to the North Shore, so it was, like, this really, like, uptight area in Chicago. Highland Park, Deerfield area, right by Northwestern. And it's predominantly Jewish and very ritzy and very different than what I was used to. And my dad converted to Judaism, and we kind of adopted this new religion, and it was kind of shoved down our throats when we were little. And I didn't like the kids in that neighborhood. I didn't like the kids that were, you know, involved with, I guess, that stigma attached to the area that I grew up in. And anybody that it's funny, like, I'll meet people that are from my area, and I have friends, or my wife's around, or whatever, and we all say the same thing. It's like this known thing that it's just trust fund kids. That's all it is. And my dad raised my brother and I not to be trust fund kids. We had to work for what we, you know, what we got. And like I drove an 89 Ford Probe in high school while everybody else like drove their mom's hand-me-downs like Range Rovers and Mercedes and whatnot. And you just feel out of place. You just don't feel quite right. And that didn't help, because I never felt like I fit in. I always felt like I needed to impress and tell grandiose stories and, you know, do this and do that to try to fit in. And I always wanted, and I always earned for that, like, or yearned for that idea what Peter was talking about, the people around me. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be cool. And I never felt like that. So when I moved to this different area and new schools and whatnot, my dad was in the record industry, and I grew up with great stories and great music. My dad's basement was like a record store, pretty much. So I got to hear like cool stories about, you know, who he met and who he worked with, and I got this idea that like I got to find the hippies in school, because they're the ones that are cool, because that's what I perceived as cool, was like kids that listened to like Led Zeppelin or Jimi Hendrix or the Beatles or whatever, and smoked really bad weed and drank their parents' liquor. So I found those kids, and they were great. And we became friends immediately, and started hanging out with them and this and that. And I think I had my first drink when I was in sixth grade. I don't know what age that is, but it was sixth or seventh grade. And I remember the feeling of like that comfort and that my inhibitions were gone. I felt like I was on top of the world. I felt like I could talk to people. I finally fit in. That hole that was inside me that I got thrown into therapy for. When you're in a Jewish family, you get thrown into therapy a lot, especially in like a divorced family, because they don't want to deal with it. And so they throw you some Jewish, therapist, and we talk about our feelings, and it was bull crap. And I remember her always asking me, what's wrong? And I can honestly look back at it now, and I could identify with this feeling inside. I knew there was something wrong. I did. I just didn't know how to put it into words. I didn't know how to say, I'm scared all the time, I feel empty, and I'm, clinically depressed at the age of, 9 years old, and I want to be somebody, but I don't feel like I'm ever going to be that person. Like, how does a 9-year-old really, put that into words? And that's what it was, essentially. And what it was my alcoholism just dormant, just sitting there, hanging out, waiting to have some fun when I had that first drink, which it did. And I remember it very clearly. We used to get this weird Russian guy named Rob to buy us liquor. He was a cab driver. So we'd pay him extra money, go get booze from the local liquor store, and we'd get drunk. And I hate that when people drink up here. And you hear the, it annoys me. So sorry. So I remember we did this DARE program, out of grade school and junior high, because in my town, we had some epidemics where I grew up. The thing is, when you have trust fund kids, they like to do really bad things, and a lot of kids die from drug overdoses because of it, because they have money, and they have nothing else to do on the weekends but spend that money. Their allowance, I remember going over to my friend's house and be like, Mom, I need money for the weekend. And it's literally just bills being handed to them. I was like, wow, okay, that's how this works. So I capitalized on that later when I became a junkie. It was great. I used to utilize it all the time. But in the beginning stages, they did this intervention program in junior high because we were having issues in our local high school with drug overdoses. And I'll respect the group conscious here about not talking about drugs, but it is part of my story, and I'll be very cautious, and it may slip, so I apologize. So all the drug addicts laugh in the background. So we were there, and we're at this juvenile treatment center, and they're doing this really corny, cheesy video for all of us, and kids coming up Scared Straight program, being I'm in rehab now 30 days, and I come from where you come from. I'm this is not scaring me. I want to learn more about what alcohol has to offer me, actually. And I remember it, the video came across, and it was it looked like a glass of vodka on the rocks. And mind you, I'm 11, 12 maybe at this time, 13. And I start to salivate at the sight of that. Now, I don't know a 13-year-old that salivates at the idea of just liquor on the rocks, but I did. And I had this I need some of that right now. And that should have been a warning sign for me, stop now, maybe talk about this. This is an issue, probably. But I didn't, and it ended up ruining every weekend for me because I was the type of guy that would just go, 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 go. And I don't know what it is also, and I find this common in a lot of alcoholics that drank at a young age. I could drink a lot. A lot. I was a kid that would hold the bottle up and guzzle it just to impress people, and I wouldn't die. I don't know how, but I didn't get alcohol poisoning, and it was to fit in. It was to impress. I can outdrink you. I can do this. I can do that. So what ended up happening was, on the weekends, if there was no liquor, I got really upset, physically anxious, and it started to affect my mood and my emotions, and it never did that before. And that should have been a sign also that maybe you're an alcoholic at the age of 13 years old. But I didn't look at that. Who's going to look at that? So I just kept going and going and going. And it came to a point where it was just, it manifested in just different areas of my life. And I got to high school. And in high school, there was a bigger, better scene that was going on, so to speak. And I got involved with the hippies again, unfortunately, and a lot of pants and really crappy dreadlocks. And Eeyore tails, they used to wear that a lot. Anybody that goes to fish will know that. Tommy knows what I'm talking about. And I met all these kids, and because my dad did what he did, I had the luxury of being able to flaunt concert tickets to a lot of the older kids. So I made friends real quick with them, and I was introduced to a substance that ruined my life completely, and it brought me down quicker than anything else. I never could imagine how quickly it grabbed a hold of me and just took me down. And that's why I say, like, I'm going to respect the group conscious, but at the same time, like, if I didn't do that, I wouldn't be here today. It brought me in much quicker, you know? And I'm grateful for that. Because if I just drank, I don't think I would be standing in front of you right now. I think my story would have been much different than it is today. And so I started doing that, and it ended up, you know, taking a hold of me. And that was our epidemic out there. A lot of kids died of heroin overdoses in my town. And they would have town hall meetings at schools and whatnot, and it just manifested itself. And that physical dependence grew even more than the alcohol did, and I was, like, really sick all the time, and I didn't know what was going on and this and that. And apparently my wild antics were... My brother was in SIU at the time, and they trickled down to him in Southern Illinois. His friends were calling him saying, "Your brother is out of control. Something needs to happen. I know what he's doing. He's doing this and this." So my brother got scared, and he ratted me out. And I remember my dad busting through the room going, "Where is it? Where's what?" You know? And he looked everywhere for it, and he found it. He was smart. He's like, "I used to do what you did. You know, I was hip one day." I'm like, "All right." And he found it in my, like, I think it was like my bar mitzvah jacket in, like, in the inside pocket there. And he gave me an ultimatum. It was leave or go to intensive outpatient for adolescents. So I did the intensive outpatient thing. And the problem was like, I didn't want to stay sober. And that's the problem when you get here. If you don't want to, really, there's not an inkling that you have a problem, then there's no point. I believe, at least, because I came in here a few times not wanting to stop because I liked it. I liked it a lot. I didn't stop drinking because I didn't like it. I stopped it because I didn't like the consequences that came with it. So when people say, like, you know, "My best day drinking is better than my worst day sober," like, no, it's not. You're a liar. You're definitely a liar. Because drinking was fun, and at least for me it was, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. I just didn't know how to manage my life on it. I didn't know how to do it successfully. Everything else fell way behind on the spectrum of what was important in my life when that came into play. And I always put it into, like, this analogy of, like, it was like a trust fall with, like, the shittiest friend in the world. And knowing that he's going to drop you every time, and you just go back to it, and it's like, you know, "Hey, catch me," and he just drops you every friggin' time. And I would think, okay, he's going to catch me this time for sure. And he, no, flat on my ass all the time. And that's how my life was like, I would always go back to it thinking that this is going to make it better and I can do this successfully. And I never could. So I was in that IOP program for a while, off and on, here and there. And I did not want to be there. I hated everybody. And I was introduced to a young person's group when I was in there, and I did not like them at all. They were way too happy and way too corny. And I was just like, no, this is not, I'm not digging this at all. So I just stopped going. And they tell your parents when you don't go, apparently. So I got in a lot of trouble. And it went back and forth and back and forth with my father and I, and my mother at this point, because she caught wind of what I was doing, that at the age of 17, I was kicked out of my house, and it was the hardest thing that my dad ever had to do. The relationship that my father and I have is very, very special and very unique, because we are literally like best friends. Told him everything when I was growing up. He was my staple. You know what I mean? When your mom leaves, you find a rock, you know, if you can. At least for me, I did. My brother and I, and that was my dad, you know. My dad let us rollerblade in the basement after seeing Mighty Ducks, because that was what we did, you know what I mean? Like, we ate TV dinners before my stepmom came in and watched football and sports on TV, like, all the time. You know, that's just, we did dude stuff, you know? And he was my staple. And he was my pillar, so to speak. And, you know, he was codependent to the extreme, let's just say. It was very hard for him to kick me out. Like, he took the door off the hinges, that whole thing that you do with, like, your kids and, like, you know, no video games and all that. But he always buckled. He did. And he kicked me out, and I remember it. And it was tough. And you could just, if you could see the look on his face, it was just torture for him. And a few weeks later, he ended up in the hospital because of it. He thought he had appendicitis, and they took his appendix out and sewed him up, and he ended up having diverticulitis. So he almost died. And he tells me that all the time. He goes, "It was the stress that you put me through. You literally almost killed me." And I did. Almost literally killed my father from the stress. So I remember I'm homeless in Chicago. I'm doing this couch surfing thing with friends. And when you're homeless and you don't have parents, you know, to really reprimand you, high school is not really an option at that point. Like, you don't want to go to school. You have no one telling you to do anything. So I dropped out of high school at 17. And my high school, you know, in U.S. News is ranked in the top 100 high schools in the country every year. If I were to just graduate from there, I could have gone to any school that I wanted to. And I blew that chance, and I blew that opportunity. You know, I did well on my testing. I wasn't the smartest kid in school, but I did well enough where I knew I could be successful, and I blew that chance, and I blew that opportunity real quick. And I remember, bless you. And I remember my dad contacted me when I was homeless, and I was wearing out my welcome. That's when the story started coming up. My mom knows what you do, or my dad knows what you do, and you need to leave. Like, I got woken up with a shotgun at one of my friend's house by his dad, saying, "You need to get out of the house now, because I don't trust you, and I know what you do." And it just was horrible, and I felt so crappy. And my dad met up with me, contacted me, and met up with me, and he gave me this ultimatum again, because he couldn't let go. And he pushed this pamphlet in front of me, and it said Aspen Achievement Academy. He goes, "If you go here for a few months, you can come back home and we can work things out." Okay. And like, they had like an equestrian program with like horses, and it was in Utah in the desert and the Red Rocks, and it looked gorgeous. Well, he duped me, because it wasn't the school, it was the insane boot camp aspect of the program that I was going to. So I get to Utah, and I get off the plane, and there's like these two beefcakes just waiting for me, going, "Are you Brian?" Like a limo driver, it says Brian. I'm like, "Yeah, it's me, I'm here, you know, my chariot awaits." And they just threw me like this van and drove for like 3 hours, it seemed like, to low Utah. It's like southern Utah. And they kicked me out of the van. They put me at base camp. I had a strip search. I had to do like the whole bend and cough thing, which was weird. And they gave me a tarp with seatbelt straps and bungee cords, and it was about 35 to 40 pounds of gear, and it said, "Make your backpack, learn how to do it once, and then go." I don't know how to do it, so they ended up having to help me, and they were cussing me out the whole time. And what I didn't know is that you are a ward of the state when you go to these programs. Your parents sign you over. You are their property. That's why they no longer exist, because children died in these programs a lot. Because the majority of the people that I was with were like ex-military. My counselors were really rough guys, and they've been through some crap, and they were not pleasant, and they knew who we were, and they knew our story, and they didn't like the idea of us being disrespectful to our elders and our parents and our peers. And morals and ethics they had, and I did not carry any of those at that time, so they didn't like me very much. So I ended up doing this whole program, and I hated every minute of it in the beginning. I would write my dad all the time saying, like, you know, "I don't belong here." Like, there are kids that, like, try to burn down their school and, like, kill their mom in their sleep, and I'm just a junkie, drug addict, alcoholic. Like, I don't need to be here. I'm not that bad of a kid. And I would meet with an actual clinical therapist once every 2 weeks. And my dad tells the story later on when I got sober. He told me, and it's funny, because when I would meet with her, she would have one-on-ones with my dad back home in Chicago over the phone. And they would talk and tell me how my progress was going and whatnot. And my dad, being the beautiful codependent that he is, was like starting to second-guess himself. Like, maybe he doesn't belong here. Maybe I made a really bad decision on sending him here. And the therapist was like, Peter, by far, your son is the sickest kid that we have in this program. And that just goes to the whole idea of, like, disease of perception. You know what I mean? In my mind, I'm cool. You know what I mean? Like, I dabble a little bit here and there. But the reason being was because I stood the strongest chance, or I had the highest risk of death. I was going to die. And I remember I was there for, like, 2.5 months, almost 3 months, maybe. It's kind of a blur. And at the end, it was beautiful. I mean, it was absolutely stunning. And I remember I felt happy. And I felt really good, and I didn't know why. And I didn't put into play that I had been abstinent for 3 months with no drugs or alcohol in my body. And I was taking an antidepressant at the time as well. And I was being physical and exercising and doing what 17-year-old kids are supposed to do, which is, like, live life. And I didn't look at it like that. I didn't put the two together. And the day I got back, I had a needle in my arm. I didn't know why, you know? And it all went away. And I lost everything. And it was just back and forth again for the next year and a half. And it got to a point where I got really physically ill. And I had to go to the hospital. And I had staph infection. And I was on a regimen for vancomycin. They had to put a pick in my...
What ended up happening was I ended up being in detox for like 34 days, which is like unheard of, you know what I mean? Especially for what I was doing. I was really sick. And my dad and the therapist talked, and it was the first time I heard the spiritual principles behind each step from a therapist. And it started to make sense a little bit. It started to resonate a little bit. It started to give me hope. And that's what I lacked. And they gave me the idea of geographical change. So they sent me down to Turning Point in Tampa, and did a 30-day stretch there, went to Boca House right afterwards, and that was just chaos there. In 2003 or 2004, Boca Raton, Florida was just a cesspool of just every worst human being from the Northeast, it seemed like, that just gravitated in like this crappy motel of a halfway house, and everybody was using. There was not a single person sober. It was very hard. And that's the problem with halfway houses, I found. And I went to one, I lived at one for almost 9 months, is that the road to recovery and the road to disaster is sleeping in the bed next to you sometimes. And it's scary. And it really shows where your willpower is and where your want and your strength to be sober lies, you know? And it does. And it was really tough. And I ended up going back and forth, and I got kicked out. I ended up back up home, and my dad woke me up in my brother's apartment. I was knotted out in the hallway. And he said, this is your last chance. You can go back to Turning Point again. You're going to stay a while or I'm done. And I remember the look on his face, and there was that look of just like, it was in a car ride actually. I remember the look on his face, and it was that look of like he was officially done with me. I was dead to him. And a year later in sobriety, I remember, it was one of those looks that you could feel in the back of your head, like when I was walking down O'Hare Airport, like, I could feel it still, and it was just there. And I remember him telling me that a few weeks prior to that, he met with our rabbi and, you know, talked to him, and he said, you know, for spiritual advice about his son, you know, who was dying in front of his eyes. And, you know, you go to a rabbi, a clergyman, or, you know, someone that's holy, so to speak, or has spiritual guidance, and you expect this idea of like getting hope or faith from them. And the rabbi told my dad, you know, if your son dies, at least he's at peace. You know, and no father should ever have to hear that about their child. But that's the only hope that you're given at that moment, is that if he dies, at least he's not in pain anymore. And I put him through that. And that's the common theme I found with a lot of alcoholics, is that it was always about, you don't know what's going on with me. You don't know how I feel. You don't know me. You don't know what it's like to live my life. And it's like, fuck that. You don't know what we did to these people that loved us. We were horrible human beings. I was a horrible human being. I didn't care about anybody. You know, and I have dogs now. I don't have children. But, like, if I had to kick my dog out because he chewed up the couch every day, like, I couldn't do it. And I don't know how our parents do it. I don't know how they let go. You know? And when you really think about that, that's when those feels start to kick in. And I remember I was told that when I got sober, the good thing about getting sober is that you're going to feel, and the bad thing about getting sober is that you're going to feel again. And it was true. It was really, really hard for me. And I got sober from my dad in the beginning. And I tell anybody that's in treatment or giving this a whirl, whatever brings you in, ride it out. You know, roll with it. Because eventually, and hopefully, there will come a point in time where you, that pop happens, and it's like, okay, I need this for myself, and this is starting to feel good, and this feels really good, actually. And the idea that I would stop obsessing over alcohol just was not plausible to me. And they said, do these simple things and find a God, and I promise you it'll stop. And I'm like, no, it's not going to stop. There's no way. And I remember it was my first spiritual experience. I was like 9 months sober, and I was like driving down Bayshore, and it's winter time, and it's like 73 here, obviously, and the sun's going, and I think like Allman Brothers was on, and it was like a really, really good song, and I was digging it, and goosebumps kind of came over me, and I just felt okay. And that was a feeling I hadn't had in years. It was that idea of like, and I know a lot of people can relate to this, is that day where you realize nothing is chaos right now. I'm content. My life isn't in shambles, and I'm happy. And once that realization comes, like, it wasn't a burning bush experience. It was, I don't remember the last time I thought about wanting to take a drink was. And that's a freaking miracle, one. And two, I don't remember the last time I was happy without something, an alternate substance entering my body to make me feel that way. So I continued. That was, like, my moment where I was, like, it took me a long time to do the steps. I was one of those. It didn't come easy to me. I hated people where it was like, you know, oh, it was easy, and I started sponsoring at 6 months, and I'm like, no. I wanted to use like every day for a long time. And I had to just hold on to my seat, they said. You know what I mean? Just sit on your hands and just wait. And it was very, very difficult. And with that, I was able to attain that faith and that hope that I like to just slam down my sponsee's throats, because that is the only thing that keeps me sober. It's this idea of that I forget that I can see from here to that wall and God sees from that wall and beyond. And I always lacked that trust. I always lacked it. When something went wrong in my life, I was doomed immediately. It was never going to get better. It never will get better. And I suck at life. I might as well die. That was a common theme for me. It still is sometimes. I'm very dramatic, like I said. And if I can just hold on to that principle that AA's taught me, that you've been through worse before and you've gotten through it, correct? Yes. That was always my response to my sponsor. Then you can do this. Just trust me. And I lacked that my whole life. And I found that in AA. I found family that I actually believed. I found people that I actually believed. And the more and more I got sober, that faith and that hope opened up tremendously, and I just started killing it at life. I started moving forward, and amazing things have happened in my life since I've gotten sober. I've met amazing friends. I've met brothers in sobriety, you know. I've met sisters in sobriety. I've met incredible people. I just got married 2 months ago. That's shocking. Yeah. Really shocking. That anybody would want to marry me more so than me marrying them. And I've learned how to love myself. And that was something I didn't know how to do in AA. And it was something that I struggled with for a really, really long time. And I think that's one of the most important things that I've ever learned in AA, was learning how to have self-love. And the reason being was I always got validation from other people. I didn't know how to give validation to myself. I constantly, and I still do it today, and I know a lot of my friends do it also, is that we compare our insides to people outsides. And this baffling idea just to talk about it actually works. You know, I never used to think that it would work with therapy and everything else. Pick up the phone when you want to get drunk. I'm like, that's not going to work. You're not going to talk me out of it. But as soon as I did, it went away. And it was just, again, it all goes back to trust. It all goes back to faith. It all goes back to the idea of, like, that these guys have been doing this for a long time and they don't lie to us, you know? And the meditation today was talking about that, about not lying to our sponsees and not lying and giving this false implication or hope to these people that are coming in that this is going to be a life beyond your wildest dreams. Like, it is, but I didn't want to hear that when I first walked in. I wanted to hear that you're going to help me stop drinking and feeling this way. That's it. I don't want promises. I don't want dreams to come true. I don't want to feel like I want to kill myself every day. And I tell my sponsees that, and I work with them, and I advise them it's going to be tough. But trust me, because I've been through it, and that's all sponsorship is. As I tell my guys, this is, I've screwed up more in sobriety than you have. That way you don't have to do the same things that I did to experience that pain. And when you're about to, I can show you how not to do it. That's it. I have nothing special to offer these guys. Everything that I say has been heard, has been said by somebody else in these rooms. You know, but it's still a struggle to hold on to that idea that things are going to be okay. I'm 10 years sober, and I've heard it's a theme at 10 years. Like, I have been crazier than I've ever been in my sobriety at 10 years. My mental illness has reared its ugly head that I didn't know. Depression, all that, it's just not fun right now. But I go back to the basics that was taught to me. You know, it doesn't matter where I get it from as long as I'm seeking, you know? And that's the whole idea behind this, is that my job right now is to be that productive member of society that I lacked in all areas of my life. And that people gravitate towards me now, I think it means I'm doing something right. That people want me in their house, it means that I'm doing something right. And that's all I ever wanted when I came in here, was that feeling of self-preservation, love, and dignity, and respect, and hope. And I have all that. And the rest were just the promises that they mentioned to me. You know, they are miracles every friggin' day. And it just happens to be whether or not I see them or not. And I'll end with the fact that what came home to me real big in the early part of my sobriety, I think I mentioned it earlier, was a disease of perception. And that my day can be fixed whether or not I choose to look at it the right way. And that's all it is. Once you get sober long enough, and I found this, it's the idea of how you're going to look at that given situation in that moment. That's it. You can choose to, and I hate it when he tells me this, or my wife, you can choose to sit in this as long as you fucking want. It irks me. I hate that. But it's the truth. I have that choice now. I am not dependent upon a substance that controls my life anymore. I am dependent upon two things. One, myself to a certain extent, as much as my God will allow me, and one is God. You know, and as long as I have that faith and that hope that things are going to be okay, and that I've gotten through it before and I'll get through it again, that perception changes. And when that happens, I'm happy. And I'll be happy for a long time. And then I'll go back into a rut and wonder why it's doing this again. And I realize, oh crap, because I'm an alcoholic, one, and two, I'm not taking a single suggestion that's being offered to me. And it'll probably be like that for the rest of my life. But I accept that now. And I understand that the power of this disease and how scary it is. I buried my first sponsee a few months ago, and it was the hardest friggin' thing I've ever had to do. And he left a six-year-old behind. And it's tough. I still get emotional. I listen to voicemails occasionally, and that was a bad idea. But these people sometimes will rip your freaking heart out because you fall in love with them and because you want to help and you want to do the next right thing. And that's what was taught to me, was to extend my hand that was so freely given to me at the moment that I walked in here. And I continue to do it today. And I'm not a guru of AA. I don't even know half the big book. I don't. I don't know Bill Wilson that well either, or anything else like that, or literature or anything like that. But I know if I do the basics that were taught to me that I can live the best, most incredible life that I've ever dreamed of, and I'm doing it right now. So that's all I got, bro. Thanks, guys.